Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 29th, 2009, and this is show number 235. Well, before I get started, I want to let you know that a new episode of the Mac Roundtable podcast should be out by the time you get this show. We had Jonathan Cost of Mac Tips Daily, Adam Christensen of the MacCast, Don McAllister of Screencast Online, and Katie Floyd of the Mac Power Users, and me. My favorite part of the show was the huge list of places to find deals. I didn't know like 90% of these sites. I'm going to be keeping episode 74 of the Mac Roundtable as a bookmark just for that. Go check out the new show at macroundtable.com. Now, Jeff wrote in with a very important message. He informed me that his wife would do him bodily harm if he did not correct my pronunciation of the town of Liskard from Gaz's letter about the trip to get me the Belgian chocolates. You know, the ones that went halfway around the world? Apparently, they went through Liskard. I forget exactly how I pronounced Liskard, but I stand corrected. And to Mrs. Jeff, I sure hope you don't hurt that poor boy now. He did correct me. Alistair Jenks sent in what he calls a listener challenge. I listened to it, and I couldn't come close to answering it myself, so I throw this challenge out to you to help him out.
Hi, Alison. It's Alistair here from New Zealand, host of the currently on hiatus Sitting Duck podcast, which is at sittingduckpodcast.com if you want to check it out. I'm trying to answer a tricky question for myself and getting nowhere or everywhere fast. It's about task management for a lazy, procrastinating geek. That would be me. Sometimes I think of things I want to do, like check out screen steps. Yes, that's on my list. And just want to record that fact so I don't forget. Sometimes I need to do something at a specific time, like meet a friend for lunch. Then there are the in-between items, like remember to call Dad on his birthday and renew the car registration before Saturday. The problem here is that while screen steps is clearly a task and lunch is clearly an appointment, there are many shades of grey in between which calendars don't deal with very well. Some task managers deal with dates and even times, but then don't seem to behave like the calendar they represent. Help! The examples I have given covered different lengths of time, a specific hour, a specific day, a whole week, and eternity. I cannot find any software or preferably service which can accommodate this in a simple fashion. I currently have a family Google calendar which covers dates the family need to know about. I also have a Remember the Milk account in which I have time-independent tasks, and some time-dependent ones too. Although Remember the Milk does integrate with Google Calendar, it's not a single seamless view. What I'm after is a service, or maybe a combination of services, which will cater for all of these examples and present me with a single view of what I should be thinking about, if not doing. For the ultimate win, such a service would cater for multiple users and allow personalized views and public-private information. Mac, iPhone, and web clients would be ideal. Does this exist, or have I identified a massive market, lazy procrastinators like me, which is not being served? GTD is good if you have the motivation. What if you don't? Without casting aspersions, I suspect a lot of listeners are like me and would benefit from such a service. So, how about an audience? What can you come up with?
Okay, no silly castaways. Let's help him find the answer. I'm not sure there is an answer out there for Alistair, but if there is, one of you will be the one to find it.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
What do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Steve has sent in our first dumb question, and he sent it in through audio. Let's hear what he has to say.
Hello, Allison. This is Steve, your loving husband and loyal NoSillaCast listener. I have a dumb question for you. I've been listening to you and Bart talk about the importance of secure internet access. One of the ways to help ensure your data and passwords are not being intercepted is to use URLs that begin with HTTPS so you know your data is being encrypted. I've been banking online for quite a while now, but just notice the login URL for my bank, actually credit union, does not begin with HTTPS, but simply HTTP. So, being the security-conscious person I am, I hand-entered the same login URL but appended an S to the HTTP. However, the URL comes back without the S, so it's not recognizing the HTTPS version of the login URL. Now, as soon as I log into the site with the non-secure HTTP version of the URL, it immediately switches over to a secure HTTPS URL. Now, it seems odd that a bank would use a non-secure URL to log in all of its clients. So my question, is my login to my bank's HTTP URL secure? By the way, I love the Dumb Question Corner jingle by Victor. Thank you, Allison, for a great show, and keep up the good work.
So after hearing that dumb question from my darling husband, Steve, I thought I'm not actually qualified to answer this one. I thought it was a great question, and so I'd like to bring in a consultant to answer that question for us.
Consultant, you'll say? I've been promoted. What was it I was before? Research assistant? Now consultant.
There you go. What do you say?
What do I say? First off, well done, Steve, for spotting that this was going on at all. Exceptionally observant. Obviously, our regular scaring people with security light has had an effect, so 10 out of 10 there. The short answer, unfortunately, is no, it is not safe. So the reason why, to explain the reason why, I thought the simplest thing to do is to explain what actually happens when Steve types in www.whateverthenameofhisbankis.com and hits enter. Then what happens? First thing that happens is his browser sends out a DNS request to say, which IP address should I be talking to for this website? He then gets an answer. Then his browser sends a request to that IP address that basically says, give me this URL. And then the server writes back a response, which contains the HTML that gets put up on his screen. And in that HTML will be a text area called username, a text area called password, a submit button, and that submit button will have associated with it a URL that the username and the password need to go to. Now, in this case, they will be sent over HTTPS because he says he's transferred into HTTPS immediately. So at first glance, you might think this is safe because the bit where the password gets sent is over HTTPS. Unfortunately, before you get to that point, there's two things could have gone wrong. First thing that could have gone wrong is that the DNS could have been compromised in some way. Maybe you're in a net cafe and someone is sending out spoof DNS packets to attack you directly. Maybe your ISP has been attacked by a DNS attack because, let's face it, you get thousands of users that way. You can really do a lot of damage. So the wrong IP address comes back and some other server pretends to be your bank. If it was HTTPS, that wouldn't work because the certificate wouldn't match and you get an error. But because it's not HTTPS, you wouldn't get an error. So your address bar would be correct, the page would look right, but it's not your bank. So when you then hit the submit button, they have probably changed where it submits to, which you can't see. And instead of sending it to your bank, you actually send it to them. So that's one way they could hijack you. So it looks like your bank, the address bar is correct. You type in the username and password, you hit send, and it does not go to your bank. It goes to where the attackers want it to go. That's the first bad way. Let's assume that that didn't happen and you got back the right IP address and the website, the bank sent you back that page with the text fields and the button. If there was someone on your network, if you were in a net cafe or something, or there was a virus running inside your network, someone brought in a Windows machine and they're being bold on your LAN, or you're in work and there's some random machine somewhere within the entire corporation that's been infected with something, the information comes back to you unencrypted. So it can be changed on the way by a man-in-the-middle attack. And so the information initially came from your bank, but it's been edited on the way, and the URL that the button goes to has been changed. Everything else is the same as it was, except for where the information gets sent. So you type in your username, type in your password, hit submit, and it doesn't go to your bank because they've changed where it goes to. And instead it goes to the bad guys. If you had HTTPS, the page coming down to you would have been encrypted. So it would have been impossible for the bad guys to edit it. So again, HTTPS would have saved you. So there's two ways in which you're vulnerable because they're not using HTTPS to send you the page. HTTPS has three functions. One of them is to encrypt. The other one is to prove that you are who you say you are. And the other one is to make sure that the information doesn't get changed in transit. By not using HTTPS, those three things are gone. That's not good. So the short answer, you should always, your landing page where you actually type in your details have to be HTTPS for you to be safe.
Okay, that's a depressing answer, but I think that's something we very much need to know. And I think maybe I'll be having a little chat with the security folks at that bank.
I certainly would. To be perfectly honest, if it were my bank, I would tell them, change it or I leave. And I'm not being hyperbolic here. That's actually how serious I would take it.
All right. Well, thanks for the help with that one, Bart.
Okie dokie. No problem. And I hope it was helpful for people.
Well, let's get into some little less depressing kind of thing here. But so Kurt Beavers wrote in asking a question about how to do a podcast with two people in the same room with one computer. See, he and his friend Tommy are going to start a podcast, and they were hoping to be able to see each other while they talk. They tried using a Zoom H2, but they found that they moved around too much, and the audio quality was very inconsistent as a result because they kept moving around. They'd kind of like to do headset mics. He didn't want to spend a lot of money, so he knew the obvious answer of a mixer with a couple of expensive XLR mics was maybe not in his immediate future. Maybe later. I was pretty sure this couldn't be done. In fact, I told him so. I told him it couldn't be done. But then I got started noodling on it, and I kept thinking, and I actually came out with two ways to do this and not spend a house payment, for instance, making it happen. I've put links in the show notes to the tutorials that I built that explain exactly how to do this, but I'll give you kind of the top level. One of the solutions is kind of expensive, not as expensive as a mixer, but costs a fair amount of money, and it's very, very simple. The second is a lot less expensive because it comes with the tools that you already have on your Mac. In this case, this is all Mac-related, by the way, but it's a little more complicated. The first way to do it is actually to use Wiretap Studio from Ambrosia Software. That's at ambrosiasw.com. So Wiretap Studio allows you to pull in two different audio tracks. You can record your microphone and another source, for example, a second microphone. I tested by putting my microphone and Steve's microphone both plugged into my Mac, and I was able to record both of those at the same time. And the advantage of this is that you end up with the two recordings on separate tracks in Wiretap Studio, where you can actually edit them separately. Like if one of them, let's say you've got a little belch in somebody's voice or whatever, you can clean that up. You can change the volume. You can add special effects and all kinds of great things to it. It's non-destructive editing. This is fantastic software. It's actually what I use to record Bart and I. Normally, I put me on the Blue Icicle XLR USB interface is the way it shows up as Blue Icicle. So that's my mic. And then separately, I see Skype on the second channel. But if you wanted to do it with two people with two microphones, you actually see the two mics separately, and you can do a lot of modifications to this audio and keep working with it. And again, non-destructive editing. It's a very cool tool, but it's about $69. So if you can get it in one of those Mac Heist bundles or something, you might find that's a little bit better alternative. The second method is less expensive, but it's a little bit more complicated. To do this, what we're going to use is SoundFlower, which is free, Audio Hijack Pro, which is only $32, and the built-in GarageBand. SoundFlower is a weird application. It's a way of combining or allowing you to control your audio inputs as a separate kind of device. I don't completely understand it, but I understand how it actually works. If you go into Audio Hijack Pro, what you're going to do is add a source, an audio source, which is actually going to be your first microphone. Then you add another audio device for your second microphone, and you set them both to have their output to SoundFlower. So you've got two mics as inputs into Audio Hijack Pro, and you're going to hijack the audio from both of those, but you're going to shove them together into SoundFlower as one single channel. So let's see, reading the chat room right now is telling me, BJ's telling me SoundFlower is an extra in Audio Hijack Pro. So apparently you can add it through there, but you can download it yourself anyway. It's free. So now you've got these two audio inputs both shoved together into one output, and then you take that one output and you make that the input over in GarageBand. You follow me? So microphone A, microphone B, shove them together using SoundFlower. That combines the two tracks together. The output from Audio Hijack Pro becomes the input as SoundFlower into GarageBand. Now, the advantage of this is pretty cheap. This is only $32 out the door from stuff that maybe you've already got hanging around. You've got a headset mic from gaming or something like that. The downside is that's kind of complicated. Once you set it up, it's pretty easy, but there's some steps you got to remember to do. You got to remember to launch Audio Hijack Pro, and you got to remember to tell it to hijack both microphones every single time. And then you've got to launch GarageBand, got to make sure the input's set right. I use Audio Hijack Pro for the show. In fact, what I'm doing right at this very instant is going through Audio Hijack Pro. What I do is I combine my voice from my microphone plus GarageBand itself. I shove those two together and I make those the input to the live show over on Ustream. So the reason people can who are watching the live show can hear GarageBand and can hear me is because they're getting it through SoundFlower and Audio Hijack Pro and all these convoluted things I'm doing. So anyway, I put links in the show notes to the two tutorials. If you want simple but to spend more money, I'd go with Wiretap Studio and a little more flexibility. Or if you want to be able to save some money, you can do it with GarageBand, SoundFlower, and Audio Hijack Pro. One thing I do like about the second solution, even though it is a little convoluted, is you can stop and start as you're doing your recording. If you use Wiretap Studio, if you stop, you've stopped that recording and you start another recording, and then you've got to kind of assemble them together. So again, I like it a little bit better on the less expensive but more complicated path. I hope that helps you out, Kurt, and let us know what you and your friend Tommy come up with. Maybe we want to give your new show a listen. One of the fun things about advertising for ScreenSteps is that you guys write to me with success stories about how it helped you out. If you're new to the show, ScreenSteps is a fantastic program for documenting computer-based tasks for training manuals to instructions for family and friends. Last week, David Bogdan, who is a teacher in Japan, wrote in with this. Recently, I've been corresponding with a developer about an application, and below is a portion of his latest email. Can you guess what program I used to make the report? He said, "Thank you for your report. In my 17 years of working with software on the internet, this is far and away the most detailed report I have ever received." I love this email from David. This is fantastic. I chatted a bit more with him about this, and he also told me to pass on to Trevor, one of the developers of ScreenSteps, that all the patience and perseverance he showed in their long spate of emails about getting Japanese to work paid off. It has helped him to keep using the program. If you'd like to have such pleasant experiences in the dreaded documentation phase of your project, or just to get your dad off your back always asking the same question over and over and over again, check out ScreenSteps at ScreenSteps.com. And don't forget to use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price. Well, I've been using Windows 7 now for, I think, about 4 weeks, day in and day out, and I wanted to give you my impressions of using it. Now, it's important that I make sure you know exactly where I'm coming from so there's no confusion. I'm a Mac bigot slash zealot to start with, having been on the Mac since 1984 with no service interruption in the 25 years since then in my home life. I started using Windows for the first time 2 years ago this coming January, and I actually started with Vista, never having used XP for more than brief interludes. I must say, I was not enchanted with Vista, but I wasn't comparing it to XP since I'd never really used that. I wasn't frustrated by things like all the options moving menus and names, like moving add remove programs over to programs and features just so that you couldn't find it. But instead, I was frustrated by silly behaviors compared to the always perfect and infallible Mac OS X. I did begrudgingly admit that there were maybe a grand total of two things I liked better about Vista than OS X. But those two things kind of escaped me at this exact moment. But there were two whole things. So I started to find that I really dreaded Mondays more than ever in my 30-year career. And I realized it's because every Monday I'd realize, oh, I got to go back and go on Windows. A common phrase coming from my office was things like, "People actually choose this? You've got to be kidding me." I don't tell you all of this for the purpose of bashing Windows, but rather to give you the flavor of where this review of Windows 7 is coming from. I thought maybe Windows 7 would be an improvement, so I jumped into the deep end. All right, I'm going to break this up into three categories. First, the good, then the less annoying than Vista category, and then finally the still annoying and new annoying category. Some of the things I like about Windows 7 will actually show up in the annoying category as well as the good category because they did something slightly wrong to what was an improvement. All right, let's start out with the good. Search rocks. I found a file with one word in it that I had to find. Found it really, really quickly. Search in Vista was a complete and utter joke. Literally, people laughed at me because I thought it would work. I thought, what am I doing wrong? It's not working. And they said, you're trying to use search? Search doesn't work. But Windows 7 search is fast and really easy. I especially like searching for applications through the Start button. I'd installed Launchy, which is a free low-end application launcher, which gives you kind of the basic functionality that you find in Quicksilver. But with the Windows 7 search, it's really a pretty quick way to open applications, so you don't need Launchy. Now, I originally was going to put search under the annoying category, too, because there was no obvious way to do any kind of meaningful Boolean searches. At first glance, you can only filter your search by date or size. And it searches all the way, not only inside the file, but it also searches the path name. So you get way too many hits. For example, I needed an Excel file that had the word user in it, in the title. And since I was searching my home directory, which has the word user in the path, search returned every single file in my user directory. That was a big help. Luckily, I thought to ask a consultant friend of mine about search because I couldn't believe it would really be this lame. He gave me some hidden tricks to get really rich capabilities for search. I still have to give Microsoft a few hits for making this hidden, but at least it is there. Let me give you a few of the pointers he gave me. If you look at a folder in the detail view, you'll see pull-down arrows, you know, next to name, date, modify, type, size, etc. Now, I assumed that those were the usual sort buttons, right? That you click on date and you can sort by date or size or whatever. It turns out those are filters. So if you click on one of those pull-down arrows next to date modified, for example, you'll see a calendar to choose specific dates to filter on, or you can choose last week, earlier this month, earlier this year, or a long time ago. That's the easiest tip. Let's take it up a notch, though, for the geeks amongst us. In the search field, you can enter terms like type colon PDF, and then your search results will filter to only PDF files. You can try, say, date modified colon and then the date, and you get everything from that date with your search query. If you want to learn all of the search syntax, he suggested you go to MSDN and TechNet and look for Windows search syntax, and then go crazy with it. All right, I have to admit, search rocks on Windows 7, especially if you compare it to Vista. Okay, here's another thing I really like. If you hover over the icon for an application in the dock, or, well, whatever they call that thing, taskbar? I don't know. They got all these different names depending on where you are on it, so I'm going to call it the dock so we're all on the same page. Anyway, if you hover over the icon in the dock for the application, the open windows for that application kind of fly out in space in a small, actually a kind of large thumbnail. You can click to go right to that window, or you could right-click and close it from there. I have a habit of leaving a lot of windows open, and it's a really fast way to close applications. It's pretty, and it's very, very functional. Now, here's another one. If you drag a window to the top of the screen, it maximizes it. It's a very natural action, very, very easy to do. I also discovered that if you have a two-monitor setup, one above the other, if you stretch the window to the top rather than dragging, it makes the window stretch to the full height of the two screens, spanning them. Now, that was really cool. But I want you to wait until I get to the annoying portion to hear a little bit more about that. Control panels are now available in a long list right off the start bar. That works really well. Very happy with that. Now, this one sounds stupid, but Windows 7 makes really happy musical sounds. The first time I heard it, I had on headphones, and I just sat there smiling. It was very pretty sounds. I know that's stupid, but it made me happy. If it makes me calmer when I'm working on Windows, it's a good thing, okay? Now, this is kind of I got to bash Vista to get to why it's good in Windows 7, but I thought there was actually something in Windows that I didn't understand, because I was never able to click precisely between two letters. Like, I'm trying to hit between an A and a B, for example, it would be to the left or to the right of that location. And I thought it was just me, like maybe the cursor location was slightly different with respect to the pointer from the way the Mac does it. But then I started watching other people who've only ever used Windows, and they click like 2 and 3 times to get it in the right spot. Now, maybe I just work with a bunch of spazzes and you can click in the right spot, but it's something I experienced all the time. Now, I can't swear to it, but I think it's easier in Windows 7 to click right where you want in a line of text. All right, now let's talk about something that stopped being stupid like it was in Vista. Here it is. Windows 7 keeps track of external monitors. Now, that sounds really stupid to say that's a big deal, but I experienced this random number generator that was Vista and second monitors. I would plug in the second monitor, and it was unbelievable the number of different things that would go wrong. Sometimes it would be mirrored when I didn't want it mirrored. Sometimes it would be a really low resolution. Sometimes I would actually have to reboot because I couldn't get them to talk to each other. I had trouble adding external monitors projectors. I couldn't get projectors to work right. Twice, with people actually watching, twice I had witnesses to this, I would be sitting there with it as an extended display, and suddenly it would switch to mirrored display all by itself. I mean, literally nobody even touching the monitors. It was unbelievable how literally a random number generator. So anyway, I switch over to Windows 7, and it just works. I set up the laptop to an HP in one office with the upper monitor, say, 50% over to the right because it was kind of off at a diagonal. I unplugged it, put it to sleep, hooked it back up to my Apple monitor in my office from the day before, and it remembered the correct and completely different placement of that monitor. In my weeks of testing, plugging and unplugging, it has not once exhibited unexpected behavior. It hasn't even switched randomly to 640 by 480 mirrored suddenly like Vista used to. So, I gotta say, that's really good. Now, everybody said it was only me, but it happened so often I couldn't believe it was just me. All right, time to get into some of the annoying category. Remember that I liked being able to drag the window to make it full size? Well, I seem to trigger it all the time when I don't mean to. I'm constantly swearing at it to stop doing it. And remember I enlisted under the good category that I like how I can trigger a window to be full screen vertically between two monitors, one above the other spanning? Well, I trigger that one accidentally so many times, that's on my nerves too. I wonder if there's an adjustment like wait until I hover for more than one full second and then execute the full screen maneuver. All right, next up. When you're installing software, user account control kicks in pretty much as it should. On the Mac, if you try to install software, it asks you for your admin password. Perfectly reasonable thing to ask for, I think, because you want to know when you're installing software. On Windows 7, a window does pop up, but it doesn't ask for an admin password. I really think it should. Kind of lame, but at least it does warn you, right? Well, it doesn't do it quite right. It hides the warning underneath all of your other windows. So you're waiting for an installer to complete, and it seems to hang up. When I first started working on it, I kept force quitting all of these application installers and thinking, why is this not working? As soon as it got rid of the installer, underneath it was the shield thing blinking, and it would turn the screen black and say, oh, are you sure you want to do this? Well, it doesn't do any good if it puts it underneath and it doesn't make it, you know, blank the screen and catch my attention. I'm surprised nobody else seems to be talking about how lame this is. I almost wonder if it's something wrong with my install. If there's any Windows users out there using Windows 7 and you don't have this, if you don't or if you do, let me know because I'd really like to know if it's something funny about my installation. It really doesn't sound reasonable the way it is. All right, let's talk about folder management for a minute. In the Explorer window, you get a list of folders on the left sidebar with the little tick marks to expand them. Great. Let's say the folder you want to navigate is near the bottom of the window. Wouldn't you think that if you hit the little expansion thingy, the window would change in some way so you'd be able to see what was inside that folder since you just clicked something that says, I want to see what's in that folder? Well, you would think that, but no, not in Windows 7. In fact, sometimes when it's partially up the window, so at least if it didn't move, you'd be able to see some of what's inside, it actually scrolls that down now, the expanded folder down to the bottom of the window, so you have to scroll to see what's inside it. It's completely backwards, if you ask me. That is like the dumbest thing. Now, I did show it to somebody, and they said, I don't want it moving. I want it to stay right where it is. That's just the way it should be. But the fact that sometimes it makes it worse, that doesn't make any sense to me. All right, this next one is a wish list item because it does exist in OS X. I really wish Windows recognized focus on windows when you were hovering over them so you didn't have to click on them in order to start scrolling. There's all these extra clicks in Windows, and maybe there's going to be fewer now. I got to go back and think about that, whether it is any fewer,
But in OS X, you just hover over the window and start scrolling. You don't have to click in the window and start scrolling. Yeah, it's just a wish list. It's not worse than Vista. All right, there's a tool that I've come to rely on quite a bit. It's called the Snipping Tool. It ships with Windows Vista. It ships with Windows 7, but it doesn't launch for me. Ever. Now, maybe it did once, but pretty much never. So I think that's lame. Let's see. One time, all of the icons in the taskbar or dock or whatever you call it, all of them but two disappeared. I had about 10 applications open, but they were poof, all gone. And then suddenly they reappeared. Now, come on. That's kind of baited behavior, guys. That should not be happening. Sometimes applications pretend to open, but they aren't visible. I try to open them again, and they say, we're already open. Quitting in Task Managers allows you to try and open again, but they don't open again. I notice this happens a lot with Pigeon, amongst others. Go figure. I thought this was supposed to be exactly compatible, the same as Vista, right? It was supposed to be the same, just color flavoring. It wasn't supposed to be any different under the hood. But a lot of stuff does that worked fine in Vista. Here's one thing. They allow you to pin applications to the taskbar. Works great. Love it, love it, love it. Should have put that in there. I mean, it's the same as the dock, so, you know, I don't even care. Steal from Apple if you make it less painful. I'm great with that. Apple steals enough stuff, so that's fine. But anyway, so you can pin an application, but you can't pin a folder to the taskbar. There is one folder there and one folder only, and that is the folder you get, and shut up. You don't get any other folders. I would really like to be able to have a certain folder up there and sometimes, you know, get rid of it, sometimes put up a new one. They've done some other interesting stuff with the left sidebar. Every window has four different things in it. They have favorites, libraries, home group, and then your user folder. And then after that, you have computer and network. You cannot change the order of these things, and you can't add folders manually to the favorites list that I can find. It must be related somehow to how often you open something, whether it gets to be in the favorites list. The other thing is the users folder is now like the second or third to the last thing to the bottom of this list of, you know, standard things. I said there were four, but there's a, what is that, six, seven? Anyway, there's these things, but the list of your home folder, your user folder, is the third to the bottom on the list. I want it on top. I don't want all this other crap up there. Come on, let me put it on top. It's my machine. Anyway, here's the sad bottom line of my analysis. Even though it appears that I listed a lot more things that bug me about Windows 7 than good things, I still find it much less annoying than Vista. Perhaps the simple fact that I don't spend 10 minutes a day getting my monitor setup recognized is enough to make me like it better. I'm not sure. But whatever it is, it just feels much better for me. There's definitely room for improvement here, but if you're on Vista, run. Don't walk to go get that upgrade. If you've been waiting, I would spend the money. I absolutely would spend the money. It's so much better. Back in 1978, I bought my first car, a little yellow Honda Civic. Somehow, I discovered this lovely gentleman who called himself Honda Bob, who agreed to come to my house to fix my car. That was the beginning of a beautiful relationship between Bob and our automobiles. Ever since that day, I have steadfastly only bought Hondas and Acuras because if I ever changed, I wouldn't get to have Honda Bob's mobile service. Well, if you'd like to have in-home, okay, in-driveway, service for your Hondas or Acuras and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, Honda Worldwide. Well, it's an early time of the week for Bart and I. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. We're early this week, huh, Bart?
Yeah, well, the listeners aren't going to hear this any earlier, but for us, it's only Wednesday. So if something really interesting happens in the world and we don't mention it, it's because it hasn't happened yet.
Ah, there we go. So Bart's going away this weekend to the land of no interwebs, so or of very long latency interwebs.
Long latency and very little going through. So you can slowly and very intermittently say very little.
We should do a recording once for like 5 minutes to show people why we don't record when you're in visiting mom and dad.
My parents insist on using Skype. And not only do they insist on using Skype to talk to my brother, who's away in Canada for a year, they insist on trying to do video. Which means we get a slideshow.
Oh, that's so sad.
my brother thought that's what Skype was like until he Skyped me. And he said, oh, will you do video? I haven't seen you in ages. I said, okay. And he went, oh, wow, it moves. And I thought, well, that's what it's supposed to do.
Oh, that's so sad. It's not their fault, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's great to see them using technology because it would cost an absolute fortune to spend the hours they spend talking to them over the phone. I mean, it costs an arm and a leg, but Skype, it's 100% free.
But isn't it a really irritating conversation?
Yeah, it's almost, I think they should introduce like walkie-talkie where they'd say over.
I know when we've gotten a little bit of a high latency, it's just like, we step on each other all the time. Maybe they're polite.
No, it's quite funny because they never quite know when to break the silence. And then inevitably both speak at the same time and then you get a collision and then you sort of wait an average, a random amount of time and try again.
Nice. Well, last week when we talked, or actually it was only a few days ago now for us, there were some big storms problems coming to Cork in that area.
Yeah, it's pretty much the whole of the west of Ireland. Just draw a line down that side of Ireland. Galway's still underwater. We had massive rain again overnight last night, so the floodwaters which were going down have now reversed direction and they're coming back up.
Oh, dear.
There are structural engineers. There's bridges about to be washed away, bridges closed. Cork City, sewage works flooded, which means that, stuff goes where stuff shouldn't. Very unpleasant stuff goes all over the place. We're having a really bad time of it in this country. Now, knock on wood, so far the east of the country where I am has survived unbelievably well. There's nothing major going on here, which is unusual, because last time we had really bad flooding, it was in the east. And it was my house that flooded, along with many thousands of others, mind. But it was a really quite unpleasant experience.
Wow. I've just started scanning some images on... this is crazy. This is really bad. Does this area flood often? I mean, I know it rains here all the time.
Oh, yeah. It always rains in Ireland, yeah. But not like this. There's people... There was one lady in particular that caught my attention. She was 80... Well, she is. Thankfully, she survived. 84 years old, living in a house that was built where her grandfather told her to build because in his lifetime it had never flooded and he insisted that his grandfather had said it hadn't flooded either. So an 84-year-old woman's grandfather's grandfather insisted he had never seen a flood here. She had to be helicoptered out of her house.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So in recorded history, basically, haven't seen floods like this.
Yeah. There are parts of Ireland that flood, but this is not normal. This is really quite something special.
Now, you said that they don't have potable water anymore in that area?
In some, there's a lot of cities where the waterworks have basically been inundated by the floodwaters, along with sewage treatment plants having been inundated by floodwaters. So when you mix those two together, it gives a particularly nasty combination. So there's a lot of places that have just no running water, and then some places have boil notices, which means you absolutely have to boil the water before use.
So do they have power, I hope?
Oh, God, there's plenty of places without power, too. Water and electricity don't mix.
Well, this is a technology show, so we should probably kick in, but I wanted an update on the floods there.
Yeah. Well, in a more happy news follow-up from last week, we mentioned Belgium having been the most powerful, new president of Europe being Belgium's prime minister, and me saying, well, that means Belgium has no government again, and the last time it took 6 months.
Yeah.
Well, we swore in a new prime minister this afternoon.
Wow.
Which is kind of shocking. I'm still in shock because that's half a week.
So you guys don't elect your prime minister? It's just an appointed position?
Okay, there's general elections every, I think it's 5 years. And then all of the people in parliament choose the prime minister.
Oh.
Which basically means the parties have to agree and then they all decide who they're going to vote for.
And they agreed that quickly?
Yeah, and in theory, the king appoints them, but the king appoints who parliament tell him to. So in theory, he's appointed by the king, but in reality, he's elected by the parliament.
You have a king?
Belgium, yes. It's the official title of Belgium is the Kingdom of Belgium.
Wow. What do I know? I probably can't point it out on a map. I'm such an ugly American.
You want very small fingers.
All right, so we've covered the floods. We've covered the Belgian prime minister issue. Let's see. We're doing this without a net. Normally we have great notes because we've planned in advance. Do we have security light this week?
We have something that just popped up on the radar that's one to bear in mind. There is an announcement came out from Microsoft yesterday about a zero-day in Internet Explorer 6 and 7 on Windows 2000 and Windows XP and Windows Vista, if you're still running Windows 7 and Windows Vista. Windows 7 and Windows Vista. That'd be an interesting trick. And it's in CSS, which is kind of everywhere and kind of hard to avoid. So it's a very easy attack for attackers to exploit. As of yet, there are no reports of attacks. It's one of those, it's just a matter of time ones. So expect to see an update from Microsoft soon, and when it comes out, pounce on it or use Firefox.
Wow. So how is it? I thought a zero-day exploit, by definition, was it's exploited the day they find out about it, but now you're saying there's no attack, so that's not a zero-day.
No, it's a zero-day if the flaw becomes known before a patch is available.
Oh, okay. All right. It doesn't have to be exploited. I got you.
Well, no, I mean, it obviously has been exploited to some extent, because otherwise no one would know about it.
Okay.
There's no active attacks going on, according to Microsoft. Now, they like to say that as long as they can, because
sure.
It makes them not look so bad. But the code was released on public websites. So it's on forums.
Great.
So the code is available. So the attackers now have the code, and I'm assuming they're writing their various nasty bits and bobs and setting their nefarious plans in action. So definitely keep an eye out for an update to IE 6 and 7 and pounce on it. And in the meantime, strongly, strongly recommend you use Firefox.
Well, couldn't they just go to IE8?
Can't get IE8 on the older platforms.
Sure you can. On Vista? Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
XP?
I don't know about XP, but absolutely. I was running it on Vista. I actually took it off because I had some trouble with it. But
okay, then on Vista, that's the answer. But on XP, I am 99.99% sure you cannot run Windows 8. I hate doing this seat of the pants.
Well, no. This is because they named it badly.
But that's true. That's very true. Yes, I don't think you can on XP, and you certainly can't on 2000. I don't even think you can get 7 to work on 2000.
Okay. Well, I'll do some researching while we're talking here.
And installing Firefox always works.
Exactly. A good idea under any mark. So this does, but this doesn't affect Windows 7? Or I suppose if you're running Windows 7, you're probably running IE8?
Doesn't Windows 7 ship with IE8, so you don't really have much of a choice in the matter?
I think you can go back, though. If you remove...
Interesting.
Well, I know on Vista, I was trying forever to look for a way to replace 8 with 7, because I was having some compatibility problems. And I looked around for it, and I couldn't find it. And then finally, I found out what you do is you uninstall 8, and 7 was kind of under it.
Ooh,
like if you do like the add remove programs.
And look, you take off the new wallpaper. Oh, look, there was other wallpaper under there.
Yeah.
Strange.
Yeah.
But considering how integral it is to the OS, I'd be very surprised if Windows 7 would let you strip that out and put in an old version.
Okay, possibly. All right, so our big topic of the week.
Yes, this is very much ongoing, very much an issue that's happening. It's catching a lot of media of late, and it has me worried. So if you've been watching the tech news, you will have seen that the head developer of the Facebook iPhone app, who is, I mean, apparently, I don't use it, but apparently it's one of the most popular apps in the whole App Store. He is leaving. He's stopping developing for the iPhone because he can't stand the App Store.
Hmm.
He says he's fundamentally opposed to it and it's badly managed anyway. So he's off. Then Rogue Amoeba were having all sorts of ridiculous, ridiculous issues with one of their apps. And so they've said, we're going to keep maintaining what we have, but we're not doing anything new until this disaster area is fixed. And there was someone else. I'm leaving one out. Again, this whole flying blind thing. So good developers. I mean, there's never going to be a shortage of people making, you know, silly little apps that take 2 minutes that aren't all that interesting. I mean, there's, of those... The fart apps are safe.
Okay,
yeah. Okay, well, of those hundreds of thousands of apps, they're not all quality. So what we need as iPhone users is to have good developers making good apps for our devices that we paid good money for. And I am really disturbed by people like Rogue Amoeba, who are very well-respected Mac developers. They have a lot of expertise in Cocoa and stuff, which is all relevant on the iPhone. They get it. They design apps that behave Mac-like and iPhone-like. They're good developers. And to see them be driven out by Apple's, in my mind, incompetence, others may argue, worries me as an iPhone user. Because it's the apps that make the iPhone great. And great apps come from great developers. And great developers who put a hell of a lot of time into an app. I don't think people realize how much work it is to develop an app. And you can do all that work, and at the last hurdle, Apple can tell you to get stuffed. And then you have literally wasted thousands, if not more, man hours.
Now, a counter article is one I found about Gameloft is saying that they're discontinuing the work they were doing on Android because there's so little support from Google and the App Store is pretty bad and they're not getting the development out there that they're making tons more on their games on the iPhone. So they're stopping Android development and only going to do the iPhone. So it sounds like people are going both directions to me.
They are, but there seems to be a real big difference between games and other apps. You don't hear about games getting arbitrarily denied. When you think of all the many horror stories there have been of App Store rejections from Planet Ridiculous, I don't remember them being games. It seems as if games are somehow uncontroversial and unmessy. They seem to just sort of sail through the App Store. Whereas other stuff tends to, very innocent stuff, tends to get into the most bizarre of capers and the bizarre of holdups.
So,
I mean, the Rogue Amoeba example probably illustrates the point better than any other.
So what exactly happened? I kind of scanned the article, but I haven't read it in depth.
Okay. So Rogue Amoeba make a product called Airfoil. And the idea is that you run this program on your Mac, and it beams the sound to, is it Airport Expresses? Which airport from Apple is it that lets you plug in speakers?
That's Airport Express.
So it beams the sound to Airport Express. So you run this app on your Mac, and you choose what application it's going to take the sound from, and then the sound magically comes out of the speakers in your kitchen or wherever.
Right.
So they thought it would be nice to let it come out of your iPhone / iPod Touch.
Okay.
Which makes sense.
So this is saying I've got my iMac upstairs with my full iTunes library, and I'm going to make it play music on my iPhone or my iPod Touch sitting downstairs on the kitchen counter.
Yeah, exactly, or wherever I happen to be around the house.
Why wouldn't the music just come out of the iPhone or iPod Touch? Why do you need to stream it?
Well, it may not be music. You could be doing some internet radio or something. You could be doing anything.
Okay.
Any audio your Mac can make can be taken and sent through the Airfoil speaker.
Any audio your Mac can make through iTunes?
No. It's app agnostic. It's any audio your Mac can make. It can be from any app. It's like...
Really? Okay.
It's like you're hijacking.
Okay, that's
software.
Something...
You tell it what app to hijack.
Okay, that's something Airfoil's doing. Nothing to do with the Airport Express.
Oh, no, absolutely. That's what Airfoil gives you above Airport Express.
Got you. Okay, I'm catching up.
Yeah, Airport Express is iTunes only. Airfoil is... You choose the app, we'll broadcast it to the speakers.
Gotcha.
Or to your iPod Touch.
Okay.
So it's a nice idea. And so they made an app for the iPhone iPod Touch. And they made version 1.0. And it had all the features they wanted. So the idea was, you choose the Mac. It would show on the screen a little equalizer bouncing up and down. It would show the graphic that OS X uses to show your Mac. So you know the way if you view your network and you see all the other Macs in your network, they all have a picture next to them.
Sure.
Your iMac looks like an iMac.
Right.
That's actually, there's actually an OS X API to take the picture and make it available to programmers.
Okay.
So they're using that OS X API and they're beaming the picture that the Mac gives them back to the iPhone. So it shows up with it, so you can tell quickly what Mac you're on. And then they're also using APIs within OS X, the icon of the app you're capturing, and putting that over that screen. So you can look at a glance and say, I'm on my iMac and I'm listening to iTunes, or I'm on my iMac and I'm listening to Safari, or I'm on my iMac and I'm listening to VLC. I don't know, whatever you might be listening to yourself.
Okay.
So you have basically, a nice simple interface, equalizer, what Mac and what application, and you can see it all at a glance. Nice, good functionality. 1.0, added to the store, no problemo. Passed, check, into the store.
Mm-hmm.
On sale. People are starting buying it. They find a bug. So Rogue Amoeba, being a conscientious software company, patch the bug and submit a 1.0.1 update. No change in functionality whatsoever. They just patched a bug. Only change. 3 weeks go by, no answer from Apple. Eventually they do get an answer. And all of a sudden the app is rejected for using Apple trademarks. It takes 3.5 months to get the app back to the store.
Wow.
And it comes back, and it's not allowed to have the icon of the running app, and it's not allowed to have the picture of the Mac, even though both are taken from public APIs within OS X that Apple make available to developers.
So now, I did read as far into the article that said that, that Apple found conflicting internal policies and that they changed their policies as a result of what happened with Rogue Amoeba.
What they've done is they've fixed the symptom and not the problem. So that's the first issue. So there's many issues going on here. Why does it take 3 weeks to rubber stamp a basic bug fix? Is that livable?
Oh, I thought you said 3 months.
No. 3 weeks until they hear back to get stuffed.
Oh, okay.
3.5 months before the update gets out with functionality stripped out. So the update is a downgrade. Fix a bug and lose features.
Okay.
As a software vendor, that does not make you happy to do that to your customers. Because that's going to result in you getting it in the ear.
Well,
and rightly so.
How many apps are they having to work with a day? I mean, I heard it was some enormous number. I mean, you know, sure, 35% are fart apps, and then there's the tip calculators, but they've got an enormous flood of applications going through.
Sure, but they opened the floodgates. They should have been ready. Anyway, the main issue here, though, to me, is that there's obviously a flaw in the there's two obvious flaws in the process. It shouldn't take it. There should be a big difference between rubber stamping an update that doesn't change any features and approving a whole new app. I would imagine that one would take a hell of a lot more looking into than the other.
You're saying they should take their time putting it in the first place?
If there's hard work to be done, it's the initial approval. I mean, the actual concept of the app has been vetted and found to be sound. Because the 1.0 went in with that exact feature set.
But the thing is, Apple changed their policy on this. They said, they did change their minds.
No, they changed their mind on one small substantive thing. They went, oh, okay, you can have the icons.
Okay, but you're saying the basic problem of taking forever to get back to you and telling you to get stuffed.
That's one of the basic problems. The second basic problem is utter, total inconsistency. It's been documented time and again. You submit an app, it gets rejected, you make no changes, just bump the version number, submit it again, it gets accepted.
Hmm.
I mean, the actual workflow for an app, from what you can read from developers' blogs and stuff, is write app, submit app, get rejected, change nothing, resubmit app, get accepted, or get rejected again, in which case you blog about it, make a stink, resubmit without changes, and get accepted.
Well, now, see, you were saying that there isn't a process.
I'm saying the process is clearly very broken. There's no consistency here. And it is unbelievably slow. It should not be so slow to do a bug update. As a software company, if you know your product is buggy, you scramble to make a fix, and then it takes 3 weeks to hear back. While people are on the phone, your support is being stretched to the limit because everyone is complaining at you. And you can't do anything about it. You're completely powerless. Waste your money, waste your employees' time, ruins your image. That's hell for a software company.
Well, let's look at something that's possibly an upside to this. I've been kind of irritated that every Apple podcast, every Mac podcast I listen to spends about 60% of their time talking about the iPhone, the iPod Touch. I mean,
iOS 10, though.
What's that?
It's OS 10, though.
Yeah, it isn't a Mac, though. It is not a Mac. It is OS X, but it is not a Mac.
It is not
a Mac. So I kind of feel like, you know, Mac World Expo, all these things, it's all about the iPhone and the iPod Touch. And sure, it's been fantastic. And I love my iPhone and everything. But I want to hear about the Mac. I want to hear that developers are going nuts making amazing applications on the Mac. I don't know that they've slowed down, but it seems that all this attention on the iPhone iPod Touch has had to have diluted their efforts. I don't know what Rogue Amoeba's come out with for the Mac that's new in the last couple of years. Have they done anything new? I mean, I like the apps they have, but I don't remember them coming out with some great new thing. Of course, maybe I'm not paying attention. I see something called Fission I hadn't heard of.
I'm going to Rogue Amoeba. I'm just heading to Rogue Amoeba. How do you spell Amoeba?
Oh, nobody knows.
How do you spell
Rogue? R-O-G-U-E.
M-O-E-B-A.
Bah. But I mean, if they put their energy on the Mac, that's a good thing.
Hang on, Audio Hijack
I'm on Audio Hijack Pro right now, so I certainly don't. Using
Cast Airfoil. Airfoil would seem to be their new thing. Radio Shift.
But Airfoil is what we were just talking about. Airfoil's been out for ages. That's been out for quite a while.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, it might be an upside, is all I'm saying. And you know, I've listened to on MacBreak Weekly. His name always escapes me. Nicest guy on the show.
Not Andy.
I love Andy too, but no, I haven't actually talked to him much.
The guy who does all the media stuff.
Who's screaming into the phone? Pixelcore. Anyway,
him.
It'll come to us.
That's really annoying.
I, for some reason, certain people's names just don't exist in my buffer anywhere. But and his is one of them.
Alex Lindsay.
Thank you, Alex Lindsay. Anyway, when he talks about this, he says that to him, it's very obvious that there are these giant landmines that if you try to play in that space, you will get spanked by Apple. And he says he's been good enough at it to be able to say, okay, here's the landmines. Just don't go anywhere near them. And sure, it limits what can be done, and it's unfortunate, and we wish Apple would act differently. But he says he's been able to do spectacular development where he just doesn't play in their sandbox.
There are definitely clear landmines that any idiot can see. Don't write an email app. It's not going to get in. Don't write a podcasting app because iTunes is going to start doing that. Anything really that iTunes might start doing, you're probably going to get stomped on.
Don't use the word iPod in the name of anything you do. Don't use the word Mac in the name of anything you do.
Even if it's the International Mac Podcast.
Precisely.
We're supposed to call ourselves.
iPod RIP. Your name in as something that no one can figure out what you are.
Yeah, but here's the other thing. Massive inconsistency again. Approved without issue, Mac OS Ken.
Right.
Rejected repeatedly, International Mac Podcast.
And evidently nothing political about that, simply random from what we can tell on talking to Ken.
To be perfectly honest, I think it's because Ken, he's a big podcast and we're a little teeny minnow.
No, I don't think so. I can't remember the name of the podcast right now, but another really big podcast had the word Mac in it and they got rejected. It was much bigger than Ken, so... I think it's back to the random, like you're talking about. Right. I mean,
I definitely agree with Alex that there are clear and obvious giant big landmines that you should definitely not trot in. But there's hidden landmines all over the place. Apple rejected the Podcaster app because of a future feature that was completely secret that would come into the next version of the iPhone OS, but no one could possibly know about. And they rejected it for duplicating iPod app functionality.
Right.
That was completely hidden from the public.
Didn't exist. Sure.
And Rogue Amoeba got stomped on because of an internal policy that's completely opaque to developers. They have no idea. It did not violate the actual agreement with the developers, but it violated an internal hidden policy. So you know half the rules, but only half the rules.
So let's say this were the next scenario. Apple retains its position of being arbitrary and capricious in their decisions, but their decision process, this arbitrary and capricious decision process, is public.
Well, it can't be. If it's going to be public, it can't be arbitrary and capricious. If they're going to make it public, if they're going to make it transparent, it's just going to have to cease to be arbitrary.
No. I'm saying have it be a process that says, if you happen to call on a Monday, that's when Bob works, and Bob's like this totally mellow dude, and you know he lets anything in.
He'll approve.
You send it on Wednesday, you know, Frank, God, he's got a stick up his butt. He is not probably going to do it. But you know what? If you spell the name wrong, sometimes you can get it through. So that's an arbitrary and capricious policy. And yet, if it were public. So there's really, to me, there's two pieces to this. One is that it's secret. And I think the secret policy problem is worse. You can have rules I don't like, but if I'm going to spend my money and time, tell me what those rules are and I'll play by the rules.
Yeah.
You know, if I have to put an E on the end of Mac and call it Mace and it gets in and then turn an update that turns it back to Mac. Okay. You know?
Yeah. No, I think there's two obvious things that need to happen. If they want to see this improve. Personally, I think the whole thing should just be thrown out and we should just be allowed to publish apps. But leaving that aside, that's just not going to happen. Apple do U-turns, but not that big. So if we accept that it has to exist, many people will argue, but let's just pretend. The first thing that has to happen is all the rules need to be public, not just a few of them. We need to know exactly what the playing field is. And the second thing is pre-approval. You should be able to go to Apple and say, I have not written this yet. I am going to write an app that does this.
Right.
Is that a go? Is that go or no go? And because some of the rejections are for technical things. You do bad UI, the thing crashes, they reject it. That's fair enough. That's your fault and you can fix it.
Right.
But when they reject you for some sort of arbitrary rule that you didn't know existed, you're hosed and you've spent so much money and no amount of technical fixes can fix a problem that isn't technical.
Yeah.
So if they could at least get rid of the, for want of a better term, political problems so that you know that the concept is sound, then you go and you write the app and you may write it badly and they may reject it anyway. But not for the idea. They just reject it for your implementation. And in fairness to them, when they reject you for your implementation, they actually point you at the problem. They'll send you a screenshot and say, we tried to do this, this is what happened. Or we did this and it crashed. Or you're using this UI element here really badly. It goes against our user interface guidelines. I mean, they do that kind of thing when it's a technical problem. And that's fine. You fix it as a programmer and you resubmit. But when they come back to you and say that the whole concept is null and void and you spent 1,000 man hours or more, uh-oh. That's the kind of thing that if you're a small software vendor can kill you.
I like that idea of the pre-approval thing where you give the basic structure. Now, that's a little dicey because you can say, this is all I'm going to do. And then while you're working on it, you get this much better idea to add this extra functionality and you could still get rejected. But at least you would know if your basic idea.
Yeah, but you'd have a fallback. So you add in a few extra features and they're rejected for those. You fall back to your original idea.
Right. And again, having the rules. I mean, a Venn diagram, you know, here are the landmines. Don't step here.
Yeah.
So, well, maybe a company as big as Rogue Amoeba coming out, you know, I should say as popular as Rogue Amoeba coming out and saying, yeah, we're done. We're until they start getting their act together, we're out of here. Maybe that can put some pressure on Apple since it actually did get them to change this one policy by the loudness of their problem.
Yeah. But what it's done is it's changed a hidden internal rule. So the actual real problem that there are hidden internal rules hasn't actually been fixed.
I understand.
So Rogue Amoeba, were let in.
I got you. No, I understand that. Yeah. What I'm saying is maybe by them saying we're stopping for a while, maybe that also will add to the fire to say, look, you guys got to at least publish these stupid rules.
I hope so. The other thing that may open Apple's eyes is if, now we don't, this hasn't happened yet, so this is still an if. But if a year from now there are a lot of good Android phones, their APIs and their stuff is all open and easy and hassle-free. You just write the code and you push it out there. Now, there's a few extra complications for developers because you don't know whether or not the thing has a keyboard. You don't know whether or not the thing has this type of screen or that type of screen. You have a whole rake of unknowns, whereas on the iPhone, you know it has an accelerometer, you know what screen size it has, you know it can do multi-touch, and you have APIs for dealing with it. You don't have that luxury on the Android. But on the other hand, you write the software, you test it, it works, you publish it, you make money, you're done. If that takes off, because let's face it.
As long as it's under 256 megabytes.
Oh, yeah, but they're overcomeable. There's easy obstacles to get around, really.
It's built into the Android operating system that that's true.
Not quite.
What I read said it was part of Android.
At the moment, you can't install apps on the plug-in memory card. So at the moment, apps have to go in the internal memory, and the internal memory is 512, which is half between the operating system and apps. So that leaves 256 for apps at the moment. There's no earthly reason they can't push out an OS update to allow you to install apps into the memory card.
But Android is built to not do that. Android itself.
No, the current version of the Android OS does not support that.
Correct. Like so it's across all Android phones. It's not like a new phone can come out with a completely different tool that allows it to write to the memory card. Android itself has to change. And they had to have made that decision for some reason.
Who says it was a decision? Did Apple decide not to do copy and paste? Or did they not get around to it and then add it in later?
Oh, no, come on. This is so obvious. This is huge. This isn't a slight oversight. I don't know. I don't use copy and paste hardly ever on my iPhone, so that's a poor example for me.
Yeah, but MMS is one of those examples that everyone ridiculed the iPhone for.
Okay, that has nothing to do with Android. Why are you bringing that up? Android, they had to have made a decision here because it's obvious you would want to put applications on a memory card. That's huge. That's not like a tiny little, we'll get to it later.
Well, my point is the iPhone was incomplete when it came out. It had to be. Because you can't do the perfect device. You'll never make it to market. You get it to a state where it is functional and it works and you push it out. And then you update it. And remember, every phone that can take the updates, which is another potential little roadblock in the way of, I think it's the G1 is out of space and can't take the next version or something like that. I could be wrong, so don't take that as gospel. But any Android phone, they can push out a software update just like Apple do all the time. I mean, my iPod Touch has changed so much from the day I bought it to now in terms of what it can do purely by software. So why would we think that Android can't do the same and evolve?
Well, why would we think that Apple's not going to open up its rules and allow anybody to put any application on there then? You're bringing up something that could happen, but there's no evidence to suggest that it will. So you're talking about the future of a hardware platform or of an operating system where you're just assuming they're going to change this situation. So why not assume that with Apple? Why do you assume that they're not going to do a change to their process?
Well, okay, there's a difference between a simple technical evolution of your OS and between a massive shift in your mindset. So it's reasonable, in my opinion, it's all opinion, right? I don't know the future, neither do you. But it's reasonable, I would argue it's reasonable to assume that the Android is going to follow a path very similar to the iPhone, where the software updates are going to keep adding great new features to what exists already. Clearly, the wall that they're running towards at high velocity is this 256 megabyte limit. As apps get better, as apps get more common, and as users start to use them, that is going to be the Android's copy and paste. They already do copy and paste, so that's not an issue. But if you remember, the iPhone was beaten over the head because it doesn't do copy and paste and it doesn't do MMS. And whether or not people actually need these things, they were beating Apple over the head with it and it got done. What Android is going to get bonked over the head with is this limit. And they're going, I mean, if they're anyway intelligent, surely they're going to deal with it.
Okay, from what I'm reading, and I've read this in more than one place, it's a security issue. Let me read you what I'm reading right now. Android apps are installed on the internal memory and there's nothing you can do against it. This is part of the security concept. Each app, or more precisely, all apps assigned with the same developer certificate run in the context of the same Linux user and get file access through that user. Their user and group IDs generated whenever you install an app. All data of the app, also created files, get the user and group assigned, and thus can only be accessed by the app itself. In addition, each app, identified through its package, runs in its own Dell Vic VM sandbox. If you put the apps on the SD card, the security concept, file access, is broken. That's why you have no choice. The described concept is only part of the entire security concept, but it is the one responsible for not being able to install apps outside the internal memory.
Okay, that assumes that you're trying to put these apps onto... Obviously, you want your memory card to be readable on your PC, so it's not going to be running the Linux file system. Your memory card is going to be running a Windows-like file system, probably FAT32.
Okay.
Because you want to take the card out, stick it in your computer. FAT32 has no support for owners, groups, permissions, any of that stuff. So you couldn't put the app straight onto a FAT32 file system. Wouldn't work, for all the reasons you just outlined.
Okay.
The phone runs Linux. Linux has support for having a file system as a file, like an OS X DMG file. So you can put a Linux file system into a file on the external card and have that completely seamlessly fuse into the file system because that's what Linux can do. So it's overcomable. It is not an insurmountable wall, and I've just sort of thought that off the top of my head. I mean,
well, I suppose the handset manufacturers could build in a bunch of memory. I mean, they could build in 8 gig or 16 gig, and then it would work, right?
Because technically, I mean, in theory, it should be a massive bonus that you can actually expand the memory, because in the iPhone world, what you buy is what you get. And that's
but it doesn't do me any good anyway. I would not buy an Android phone based on the fact that I can't put more than 256 megabytes of apps on it. I just simply wouldn't do it. So I wouldn't consider it.
I expect that to change, because it's a Linux OS, and Linux can deal with these issues.
Sure.
Linux has the tools.
But they're not there today. And so these game vendors like Gameloft going off of the Android and going to the iPhone, I kind of feel like companies are going both ways, and it'll probably be helpful to both to have this movement going on.
I hope so. My fear is that the movement is going to be more one way than the other. It all depends on Apple. if developers get annoyed enough and they really do start moving in high enough volume, it's entirely within Apple's power to get them back.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, the actual
if they don't wait too long. OS,
if they don't wait too long.
Right.
But the actual iPhone OS is fantastic platform to work on. I mean, the APIs they have, the seamless access to all the multi-touch and the accelerometer and the compass and all these great things, it's a wonderful platform. You would love to develop on it. And, you know, with Cocoa Touch integrated into Xcode, it's a nice way to work. So, yeah, there's a definite pull there, but Apple have it within their power to stop being as mean or as capricious. Capricious is probably the right word. My other fear, right, because at the end of the day, I see the dynamic. At the moment, there's more iPhones than there are Androids. But I do not think that's going to stay the case because Apple don't do commodity. Apple don't do cheap. They do good. So I actually don't see the iPhone being the dominant platform in terms of sheer volume because Apple aren't going to the bargain basement in price. They just don't. They build quality products at a fair price, not junk at a cheap price. So I think Android is going to end up on much cheaper phones. So at the end of the day, there are going to be a lot more Androids than there are iPhones. And when the numbers start pulling one way, so you have the choice of a poorer platform that has more people to buy your product or a better platform with an app store that's a bit like running the gauntlet.
We'll see.
That worries me. Like I said, right, you know, I'm not predicting one thing or another. I'm flagging a worry that Apple have entirely within their power to address.
Okay. We got to wrap up, Bart.
Okay. That's it. That's it in summary. I fear that this is how we're going. Apple can fix it. I'm not saying this is how it's going to go. I just fear. It's my worry.
All right.
What's been on my mind.
All right. Well, good. I'm glad we finally got a chance to talk this through. It was a lot more interesting than I thought it would be.
I thought it was going to be horribly dull and boring.
Well, I thought I'd sit there with my mouth shut, but that didn't sound like me. So, all right. Well, hey, have a lovely weekend with your mom and dad. Give them our best. And I guess we'll talk to you in another week and a half or so.
Yeah, so the listeners won't notice this extra gap. But for us, it'll be a long
time. It's all about us.
It's all about us, yeah. Anyway, until then, happy computing.
After Bart and I got off the phone, I did verify that IE8 does indeed run under Windows XP 32 or 64-bit. So if you're running IE7 and for some reason Firefox isn't doing it for you, maybe you want to run over to Microsoft and download IE8 to make sure you don't get the zero-day exploit. Wow, every week I think I won't have enough material, and every week I end up with tons of fun things to talk about. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us soon in the live chat over at podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sunday nights. That's also known as Monday morning sometime if you're of the Australian persuasion. Until then, keep up your emails correcting my pronunciation of foreign lands, asking those dumb questions like Steve, or just send me a note to say hi by writing to me at allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And if you'd like to follow Steve too, check him out at twitter.com/spsheridan. Oh, and if you've joined the live chat, be sure to send me a tweet so I can get your Twitter handle and add it to the Twitter widget list on podfeet.com. You know, I thought it was a way of just kind of recognizing people who make the effort to come to the live show, but I've started to find myself going to my own site just so I can see what the really involved Nosilla castaways are yapping about. Thanks to Gita, by the way, for getting us that new term. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.